podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Hello, so the season trundles on as we round off the last week of November. We're at the start of a long stretch of FPL now, as mentioned last week, unfettered by international breaks as the game disintegrates into the haves and have-nots as the sharp divisions continue to impact ranks. As we move forward, we thought maybe this is a good time to have a look again at how we fit everybody in as we try to optimise our sides to get into that onslaught of game weeks to come. Oh, all right, everybody's here this week. Nick, first, you're all right, as usual?
Hey man, yeah, I'm good, thanks. Had my birthday weekend, so I'm 32 years young now. I'm 32. Do you not know my age?
We have some discord here in the Harris household.
I'm 33.
Yeah, but I'm born in 88, so I'm 32.
Speak for yourselves, lads, you're all ancient.
Right.
Yeah, no, we are definitely getting on a bit, Nick. If we can't remember how old we are, or our wives can't remember how old we are.
So yeah, exactly. I was just saying my birthday wish of a De Bruyne captain return came true, and the likes of Salah and Son remaining quiet, as did my old rat-faced nemesis on the Monday night. So who are we? Well, who got the assist? Make sure to follow us on Twitter or Instagram at wgta.fpl. You can join our league as well. The code is CPSULF. And we're also joined, as always, by the sprightly youth of the pod that keeps the younger audience engaged. Anthony, how are you doing?
Not too bad, lads. Not too bad. We're managing away after another, I think, decent week. I was saying to Tom there before we started recording, I've decided that I'm having a good season from now on. That's how it works. And this week went okay because of that. So we'll keep moving forward. Agenda for this week, as Tom kind of alluded to there, it's focus on the premiums and then who is missing out in your team in the, as a consequence of that. So you've Son, Bruno, Salah, Mane, that's just the midfielders, and there's still the likes of Mahrez, Rashford and Ziyech in there as well. Forwards, then you've got the likes of Kane, Werner, Vardy, Cavani even, Aguero, Jesus. So many options in there, but we kind of need to redistill that down because this is the hectic part of the season and obviously you can only fit so many into your team. We've correspondence as well coming up after the break, as well as Q&A. But first of all, we're going to start with the Game Week reviews.
Wow, it appears some miracle has occurred because, like, despite me moaning to you guys a lot over the course of the weekend, I appear to have come top out of the three of us. It's obviously not a huge win because Nick has somehow managed to smuggle his way to the same overall gross points, but I've won on a net basis, which I will take. It's 64 points for me this week, which I think it might be 65 actually, if Grealish has got those free bonus.
65, yeah, according
65.
To...
okay, great. Yeah, 65 points for me this week. So kind of seeing the wild card eventually come through and provide a green arrow after last week's red. I think I was down to 2 million, now up to 1.4. So 600k rank peeled off, which is always nice. De Bruyne getting those two assists for a 10-pointer. Fernandes matching him with the goal and the assist. At the back, Chilwell, Diaz, and no Cancelo, which meant that Jamal Lewis, a last-minute swap, I put him in first bench over Kilman, and so 6 points come off the bench for him. And Jack Grealish tonight. Jamie Vardy, unfortunately, just about got an assist, which was all right. I mean, it was at the point where at the start of the game, if you said, I give you an assist, would you take it or leave it? I'd leave it and hope for the best during the game. But it was kind of quite late on. So it was kind of like, yeah, I'll take it now. I'll definitely take it. I'll take anything. The only kind of thing, again, that kind of soured it a tiny bit was that I've got Ollie Watkins, who missed the penalty, hit the bar, and in the 91st, 92nd minute, had one of the kind of definite offsides. Him having that goal disallowed and also missing the penalty meant he went from, what could have been a 12-point performance down. He's actually got zero. Not the greatest end, having Grealish is a nice little hygiene factor. So yeah, 64, can't really complain too much. I'm just hoping that I can finally get a captain bang rather than the captain. Yeah, at least he's got something next week. Anthony, you're next, right?
I am indeed, yeah, in the middle of the two of you in this case. 62 points, that's gross and net. Just, it was a fine week. It could have been a much better week, but it was still, we'll take it. Forward line, definitely flattered to deceive. Kane, Calvert-Lewin, Brewster, 5 points between them, not great. Salah as well in midfield, not the greatest returns, but of course did have a goal ruled out. And I think generally I'm still quite happy to have him in my side. Jack Grealish, 10 points, thank you very much. And Kevin De Bruyne was my captain. That could have been a phenomenal score. Still, 10 points doubled, we'll take it. I've had plenty of blanks this year that it's okay. Suchek, whatever. Chilwell, 8 points again. Soufal, 2 points. And then off the bench for Cancelo was Stuart Dallas, coming in from second bench, actually, because Mitchell didn't play in first bench. That was a particularly fortunate addition. And then Martinez, disappointingly, 1 point in goals. So overall, I'm into a six-figure rank for the first time, I think, since game week one, 876k projected. So onwards and upwards, we're... it's on, Nick. I'm chasing you down. But in the meantime, whilst he may have had a lower score than both of us, I think on the Electoral College, he's definitely still the president.
Yeah, well, I technically had a higher score. It's just the net minus four makes it lower. So I had 64 points, minus four is 60. I didn't have any jammy bench points either, unlike you guys. I had Stuart Dallas with his 8 points rooted to the bench, unfortunately, this week, having for some reason decided to play Walker Peters ahead of him, which is, you know, pretty stupid in hindsight. But otherwise, my transfers paid off massively. So I did Jota and KDB came in for Zaha and Son. So... massive swing there, 13 points. Captain De Bruyne as well, so 20 points for him. And it was all about my midfield, actually, to be honest. Like, no one else got any returns. So De Bruyne got me 20, Jota the 9 points, Grealish 10, apparently, I think, with free bonus. Fernandez 10. All my forwards blanked, and the defence and goal didn't do very much either. Zuma picked up a 5-pointer, but, you know, not as good as Chilwell's 8. But, yeah, I think 64, I think. It's a green arrow just lurking outside that top 100k now. So, yeah, feeling quite happy and everything's looking pretty promising at the moment.
Good season in your sights. Right, moving on to the market forces then. And as you mentioned, Nick, your strikers haven't been doing anything, but it's not really the strikers that are in prominence in the numbers, is it, so far?
So, yeah, again, it's all about Diogo Jota, the most transferred in player this week with 200,000 transfers in, looking very much in form with 4 goals in 5 games. And again, he only cost 6.7 million, which is perhaps, you know, one of the highlights of him. He's going up again, so it might be 6.8 now, but 5.4 million saving on Mo Salah if you are looking to potentially try and cover Salah with his cheaper teammate. So he's certainly attracting a lot of attention in the market forces. Otherwise, we've got Callum Wilson. He's second most transferred in player with 117,000 transfers in time of recording. Yep. Seems to fill that third striker slot right now very nicely, especially considering, you know, very few forwards got any returns this game week. He's now got 7 goals and 3 assists, so third highest forward scoring forward, just behind Calvert-Lewin. And some excellent fixtures with Villa, West Brom, Leeds and Fulham up next. But I think we'll be talking a little bit more about forwards a little bit later on in the podcast. Otherwise, Mahrez, third most transferred in player. Obviously got a hat-trick at the weekend, 108,000 transfers in now. And Fulham at home up next. So a lot of people looking at him after that hat-trick. It would be a surprise to perhaps not see him start again, even though there's plenty of competition. I don't know what you think about Mahrez. Are you surprised to see him so heavily transferred in this week, considering the rotation risk?
To be honest, no, I don't think you could be too surprised. Just obviously, given his results, I think you'll always see a pretty big swell in popularity for anyone who scores as many as he did over the weekend. And of course, with a good fixture coming up next, you would expect him to be popular. Like, he's such an easy price point there with such a high ceiling at 8.2. James Ward-Prowse and Bruno Fernandes, also popular transfers in terms of midfielders. Defenders-wise, it's basically the Chelsea defenders that are popular. Chilwell, Zuma, James, all in the top four, with just Kyle Walker in there second in between them. In terms of transfers out, then you're looking at Wilfred Zaha leading that with Raul Jimenez, unfortunately injured, get well soon. James Rodriguez and Lucas Digne, all popular transfers out this week, with fairly obvious replacements kind of coming in for all of those. Diogo Jota, I guess, being the most popular of the midfielders, as we said.
Yeah, no surprises there, I guess, with the injured players being heavily sold. Yeah, obviously, Jimenez, we wish him a speedy recovery. FPL goes out the window when something horrific like that happens in the game. Jay Rodriguez, or James Rodriguez, as he's more formally known, the most transferred out player who's not actually injured or suspended, with 130,000 transfers out. Likes of Mane and Bamford also attracting heavy sales.
It's always interesting, isn't it? At the moment, I think we've had quite a lot of game weeks where there's been obvious transfer out. I think we've, apart from Hammers this week, it's four of the top five are all injured or suspended, right? As you said. And then in past weeks, we've had a lot of kind of obvious moves to be made. So it'd be interesting to see what happens if people start making elective rather than enforced transfers once more. Let's move on to the main topic this week then, which is, I guess, covering bases, representation, the dreaded cover, but not really about covering teams. It's really about covering the premiums. The key question this week is, can you cover all the bases in FPL? There's a limited amount of funds, but there's lots of representation to do. There's a plethora of options on offer at the upper end of the price scale. And trying to fit everybody in is the order of the day. As managers look for their team sheets, transfer screens, and agonize over, oh, who should I get? How should my team set up? Oh, but if I get this guy, I can't get that guy in. Oh, it's a nightmare. And this week coming up, for example, City are Fulham at home, Chelsea are Leeds at home, Leicester have Sheffield United. And game week 12, things shift the other way around. Spurs have Palace, but Liverpool have Fulham that week. Leicester have Brighton. Pain in the arse to try to fit everybody in that you can. So this week, we're going to be looking at quite a few of the premium players up there in the bracket, players like Bruno, asking the question, can Jota cover the likes of Salah and Mane? KDB, has he broken the Pep roulette? Kane and Son, what are you thinking about those guys? And so on and so forth. Let's start off with Bruno then, because I think this week he was one of those players that I saw in the Twitter sphere a little bit. People had pegged as the route to City or Liverpool next week. A few people were recanting on, you know, their choices, saying, oh, I can't sell him now. No way I'm selling him. And obviously a few people did actually sell him for the likes of Salah or KDB. And you'd have even doubted if you sold him on to KDB. But you know, after yet another return, another double-digit return away from home, guys, I mean, Bruno is surely one of those players whose consistency is just difficult to match, right?
See, this is the thing with Bruno, and I think I haven't owned him so far this season. I, of course, owned him in Project Restart, but his form has been absolutely ridiculous. And it is, whilst you may write Manchester United off, and justifiably you could write Manchester United off, and I say that as a fan, and you could write them off against good teams and bad teams alike, and probably more so against bad teams, Southampton kind of falling into that in-between category of not knowing what to do with them. But the thing with Bruno is he is talisman theory writ large. He is just so, so dependable. Helped by penalties, for sure, but not at all reliant on penalties either. He's a prolific shooter. In the last four game weeks, for example, he's top in the last four across the whole entire division in any position. Second for shots on target. And even though so many of those shots come from outside the box, that's not a problem. He's just so good. He's 12th for XG in terms of non-pen in that period. Did have one penalty as well in that period, but that doesn't matter. He's fine. He's able to get the goals. He continues to get them. This isn't kind of one of these, oh, he's outperforming his XG and there's no way that he's going to continue this and he'll revert to the mean. We've had enough time now to see that he's just the sort of player that somehow manages to make it happen like the best players do. He's also, obviously, of course, he's able to produce the other side, 10th for chances created in that last four, second for big chances created, though. So he's just ridiculous. Well, we've seen other players in previous years do better in terms of both goal threat and creation threat. But this year, really, there's nobody like Bruno who seems to be managing to keep the two going as prolifically and as consistently. And that's what makes him just so, so good. And so whilst people were looking at selling him on Saturday morning before everything started, I was looking at trying to bring him in, and it was looking at the likes of Grealish out, for example. Yeah. That can't happen. So now I don't know what to do again. But I think he's just a must-own.
Yeah, I mean, I saw, and I think we said it a few times this season, or at least seen it a few times this season, people were kind of saying his price point is awkward at 10.5 million. Now I think we can see that price point and call that a discount, frankly, at kind of the comparative sorts of players that he's up against. A really good way of looking at Bruno that I did indulge in. I looked at Bruno, how many points he scored from game 25 last year when he entered FPL up until now. So over that time, he's scored 191 points, 117 points last season, ridiculous 117 points last season between game weeks 25 and 38, and 74 points between 1 and 10 this season. 63% of those points, by the way, 121 of them have come away from home. Just to put that in perspective, Salah over this time frame has scored 157 points, so 82% of Bruno's 191 points. Kevin De Bruyne, he scored 132 points, so 69% of the Portuguese playmaker's points. I mean, the consistency in an FPOS asset like that is absolutely brilliant. That's exactly what we're looking for. And it's a bit counterintuitive as well, but Bruno looks like your away captain supreme. The double-digit haul potential when he's away from home is just absolutely mental. But, I mean, that entire outcome from Game 25 when he entered the game up until now just points to that 10.5, as I've said, looking like a hefty discount on next season's price, which is bound to be 11.5 or 12 if he continues at this level of velocity. Right, Nick? I mean, he's a player who's probably not going to leave your side, is he?
See, this is the thing, and all of those numbers are absolutely excellent. So obviously, you know, I'm in complete agreement with both of you that he's a fantastic FPO asset. But the way, when I look at my team, and this is my team's perspective at least, I'm starting to question how we can, I know this is basically the theme of the pod, but it's about how we can cover all bases. How can I fit Bruno in alongside De Bruyne and Mo Salah? And I feel like I'm going to perhaps try, and it's always a risky strategy, to play a little bit of premium ping pong here, because what I'm thinking about potentially doing is swapping Bruno out for 1 week, not this week, but the following week, when he has Manchester City and Salah has Fulham. Because surely, you know, as much as Bruno is outscoring Salah over the past, you know, 20 or 25 game weeks, whatever the period was, like, in terms of the underlying stats, I still feel like Salah, he's the one to own out of all the midfielders. You know, Bruno has created more chances, five more, but Salah's had the greater goal threat. In fact, in terms of shots inside the box, Salah's had 27 and Bruno's only had 12. So Salah's actually had more than double the shots inside the box this particular campaign. And I don't really want to go without owning Mo Salah against Fulham in game week 12. And the way I see it, I can bring in Salah for Bruno, and perhaps the following week I can swap out someone else, maybe even swap Salah straight out again because he's got Spurs, and bring Bruno back in for Sheffield United.
God, what's happened to you? Who are you? What have you done with Nick? That's ridiculous. I did the monocle emoji in real life then. That's ridiculous.
It's a strategy. It's like we've boomeranged a few times in the past. I think
old boomerang, yeah.
I think it's a potential strategy. I don't see the harm in it. It's worked so far in terms of taking Salah out last week.
And, it's a very unused strategy, though. That's why I'm a bit concerned about for your health and general well-being. Dear me. But yeah, no, I think that kind of... I think we can all agree that Bruno is a good asset, but it sounds like in some ways you're seeing him as a bit disposable there, which is quite an interesting take. I mean, for me, he's probably one of those players that until he does succumb to some sort of injury or some sort of rotation threat, which I completely doubt. It looks like he's got that kind of free roam role, and BDB, when he gets in, he looks like he's kind of playing a more defined midfield position, so Bruno can do whatever the hell he wants. It's always an injury. Like, he just looks like he can shithouse points from anywhere, basically. I mean, I just can't see a way at the moment that I'd be looking to get rid of him. I'm surely his price is only going to go up. I'm not too sure about that. Have we swapped roles, Nick? Except without the FPL outcomes for me.
This is the problem. Like, are you saying that you're going to go without Salah then? Is that what you're saying week?
This moves us nicely onto does Jota cover Salah or Mane? Because for me, I'd be looking at what's happened from you and Jota right now, don't you? And like, over the last four game weeks, Jota is the fifth highest scoring player, equal with Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Lloris, on 28 points. He's second shots in the box and he's fifth for non-pen XG. But the importance of the business end, isn't it? So four goals and five league games. And he's rocketed up in price from 6.3 when he started scoring game week six, all the way up to 6.8 now. 25% ownership, top market forces. That's only going to rise. I mean, with him, is it a case of casuals catching the worm? Like, there's lots of uncertainty expressed about Jota, but maybe there's a hangover of his Wolves days when we weren't too sure about him. But the reality is he's a sub-7 million player, attacking player, who plays for the league champions. Like, there's lots of less engaged managers would have grabbed him without a thought that week. Should we have done the same? Probably, yeah. But can he, I guess the judgment is, can he then cover the likes of Salah and Mane, especially in that sort of Fulham game? I think we've all agreed, we on the podcast have agreed that Salah is probably the superior asset to Mane, unless you're an Adam Hopcroft. But the question then becomes, can Jota be a cover for Salah? Like, for me, I don't know if my strategy is feeling like it, because I want to keep the likes of Bruno. I want to keep KDB, we'll speak about in a minute. Probably want to keep a few other players involved as well. I might have to hope that Jota does the job against Fulham. But yeah, it's definitely tough. What do you think, Anthony, on that?
So we're not that many weeks on from when we recorded our supporting cast episode. And I think something that we talked about in that was, you know, maybe don't force somebody to be a supporting cast member just, you know, because it might fit the team structure. Yeah. And I think when it comes to someone like Jota, the fact of the matter is that, like, you can get him in alongside your Salah. And so I think it's overcomplicating it to try and, you know, have him cover. It kind of reminds me a bit of the Pedro Hazard thing, except, you know, he's actually really, really good and might score as many as them. But at the same time, you know, get them both in. Why not?
I know. But like,
6.8 now, you know, 6.8.
But in that scenario, you already have Salah and you're buying Jota in. In my case, I've got no Liverpool at the moment. So buying Salah in is a huge imposition on one hand. Finding the funds to buy him in the context of other players being there. And like, Jota's so much easier to put into my team.
You see, thing is, Tom, is this sort of overcomplicating the sort of reason why less engaged managers are doing, you know, so well this year? Because they just go, oh, he's doing well, just put him in. And like, if it costs -4, so be it. It's
well, exactly.
Full,
that's why I'd be buying, you know, Jota over Salah at the moment. Because
would you not just put
games
both in? Because you're like, God, that Salah guy, he scored a lot before.
But what if KDB, who would go for him, has recently smashed it?
And this is why we have this segment, because that KDB guy, he scored a lot before and he looked so good on Match of the Day. And Man City are back, you know, so says everybody now after one win. But okay, yeah, Jota, unbelievable in terms of his goals and starts, like 3 goals in 4 starts so far this season, obviously 5 goals in total in the league, also particularly good form in Europe. So seems like a very dependable asset. The sort of role that he has in that Liverpool team is, it's akin to Salah and Mane in terms of the amount of shooting he can do. In fact, he's done much more of it in the last few weeks, even though he's played less, higher open play XG than both Salah and Mane over the last 4 games, even though he's played about a half less of football. Now, that said, you could point to the fact that Salah and Mane have both had offside goals and that would totally change things. And you could also say that Salah has penalties and there's no Milner around anymore, so there's no worries about duties. So you could say that Salah is a better asset in that sense. But all the same, Nick, do you not think that it's just over? You already own Jota, so maybe you're even more likely to agree. It's just overcomplicating things to try and not have him.
Well, that's why I've come up with this fail-safe plan of my own, where I own both and I also own Bruno for certain periods. So, I mean, yeah, in terms of Jota and his performances in sort of the last 5 game weeks when he sort of entered the team, his underlying stats have been excellent and they have been matching Salah, or even actually bettering, really, because even though Salah's played 4 games, Jota's played 5, so it's not a direct comparison. Jota's scored twice as many goals as Salah has. He's had more goal attempts with 12 compared to Salah's 10. More of those have been inside the box. In terms of sort of minutes per chance, for Jota it's 31 and for Salah it's 33.3, so, you know, they're very, very comparable. You know, obviously Salah's got the pedigree to a certain extent. Jota, you know, we kind of wrote him off a little bit when he signed for Liverpool. Many people did, because they saw the 40 million price tag thinking, what the hell, you know, this guy's never really delivered for Wolves in the Premier League.
They also saw plenty of gilt-edged chances going a begging while he was at Wolves as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty remarkable the sort of conversion rate he's come up with this season compared to what we've seen bar 1 or 2 fits and starts while he was at Wolves.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, he's in form. It's only been 5 or 6 games, so it's early days, but, you know, he's broken his way into that Liverpool team as well. So he's going to be starting week in, week out at the moment if he continues to score. So I certainly think he is an excellent FPL asset right now, especially if you are looking at not having Mo Salah or not having Sadio Mane. But I don't know which is the Tom strategy. I think for me, it's just, I think I can get away with getting Salah in Fulham and then swapping him back out again. So that's why I'm thinking I really want Salah for Fulham. Mm. I took the risk without Vardy this week against Fulham, paid off, but I don't think I'm going to do the same for Salah.
No, I could actually follow that strategy, because I'm looking to roll this week, and I think that it could happen. I could do it. I'm a little bit, it kind of goes against all of the kind of teachings of caution ingrained in me by the likes of boring managers like you, Nick, or the artist formerly known as Nick, I should probably say at this point. But you know, I can see where you're coming from with that strategy. And Anthony, you're laughing at us. Laughing at us with disdain?
No, I just find the whole thing funny. It's just watching this role reversal is quite something as someone who's listened to the pod for quite a while, that's all.
Don't know what's happened. I'm boring and crap at FPL, whereas Nick has become interesting and good at FPL. Christ. Things really have changed. This is 2020 in a moment.
Is Nick out hipstering you as well now with the beard?
I don't think I ever tried to be hipster. I think I was always just original without being hipster. But yeah, okay. Well, it sounds like we're a little bit skeptical whether Salah can be covered by Jota. But we are in an interesting stage, aren't we, with Salah at the moment? Where obviously there are a lot of removals with the COVID situation. Whereas a good proportion of the game don't have Salah at the moment, and obviously kind of people are manoeuvring to try to get him in, as Nick's just reflected and as I'm reflected, trying to find a way to cover him. I mean, Anthony, you've got Salah at the moment, haven't you?
I do, and indeed.
I mean, can you see kind of a world where people were kind of saying, well, okay, well, at least I can cover Salah at the moment? Is it fixtures? What is it that's kind of made it that people have seems to be a little more comfortable about Salah right now?
What's made them do it? I'm going to just say that it was just a matter of, you know, Liverpool starting, okay, Salah starting particularly well with his hat-trick or whatever, but Liverpool themselves starting slowly, and people just felt that there was fixtures that they could chase down elsewhere, that in spite of the fact that Salah had, what, 5 goals within the first 4 game weeks, they just went chasing points elsewhere. It's the faraway hills or greener aspect, and I don't think there was much more to it than that. But I think, like myself with Bruno Fernandes and not owning him, in spite of what we saw in Project Restart and in spite of what we've seen over, let's say, the first 10 weeks of the season, but I probably should have seen enough in the first 5 to, you know, not continue to go without him. Sometimes you just kind of get tied up in other moves, and there have been other moves to make with, let's say, the people who did Son in, out, in, that it just made life a little bit difficult to make that transfer and just never got around to it. And now, all of a sudden, with a game like Fulham coming up, which of course we have seen can be deceptive with the Leicester game, although I do think that Liverpool are much more likely to pile on the punishment than Leicester were, there's kind of a certain need to get him that they just didn't have before.
Yeah, I mean, Liverpool have certainly taken Man City's mantle in terms of being an attacking team, or the attacking team this season so far. It really is astonishing, actually, Man City's drop-off this year. And obviously, we're going to move on to Kevin De Bruyne in just a second because of this.
Underlying stats-wise, over the course of this season, they have been the more reliable, let's say, attacking team of the big six. But at the same time, they've scored more than 2 goals 3 times so far this year. So, like, we're not talking about a team that's, like, walking over the opposition. I think that's just generally a trend that we've seen this year, is that...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Anyone's beat everyone sort of thing, isn't it? Yeah.
But it's kind of that likely man, talisman concept complex that you have with Salah, that you can't not have him. And, as well, there's always the penalties. And with that in mind, you kind of... You know that you're only ever, you know, very... You're always just a few minutes away from a massive Salah haul. If Salah scored, you had that offside goal... given at the weekend, it was offside, not trying for that to happen. But if he had that given, this would be a very different conversation.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's almost the case, it's almost like a Salah rule. If you don't own him, that you're probably at most 2 game weeks away from being massively punished by not owning Mo Salah, because all of the data is in his favour. That eventually you get to a point of terminal velocity where you can't dodge it anymore. Interesting. And but just to kind of move us on to a similar guy, who last year at least looked like he was going to be able to, and indeed did, dethrone Mo Salah, is Kevin De Bruyne. So, I mean, we obviously were looking at Man City this year, as we did at the start of every year, thinking, oh, God, you know, what's going on? Obviously, there was a blank in game week 1, and it kind of was convenient for us to forget all about them. But game week 3, game week 4, we're all in, a couple of adverse results, and we've only now really kind of started to get back into the City groove. A very good question by our friend FPO Elf. He asked us, has anyone else noticed it's really tricky to predict which players Pep Guardiola is going to start for Manchester City? Obviously, ironically. I think that there is probably one tonic to this. And I think there's something that is kind of understated, actually, or at least has gone unsaid, which is that I think Kevin De Bruyne is the antidote for Pep roulette. I looked at his appearance data for last season. And last season, out of 38 potential games, obviously, he started 32 of them. Came off the bench three times and only didn't play three. And he actually got the full 90 minutes on 69% of occasions. And of the entire time that he could have played, he got 58% full 90s. It's pretty good. He's a sort of player who's going to be starting 84% of the time. He's the sort of player who starts 84% of the time for Pep, the linchpin of that team, and maybe a player like De Bruyne, 36 goal involvements last season, don't forget, is one of those players who, once Man City get into the groove, is going to be a player who we should all own, right? I mean, we all own him. You guys both captained him this week. Would you be saying to everybody, it's time for De Bruyne, especially ahead of Fulham at home, despite what they did against Leicester tonight?
I would have said, as I got him last week for the Burnley home match, I feel like that was like the perfect time to jump on board City, as that was the start of their fixture shift. And with the 10 points, I think he could have even got more returns, and he could have easily scored more than 10 points in that particular game, just picking up those couple of assists. As we said, there's this whole rotation issue with City, but Pep, with De Bruyne, he feels like the one player that won't get rotated. And looking at City's calendar and looking at where they are in the Champions League, for instance, they're 12 points from four games. So if De Bruyne is tired, and that's the only issue that he might miss out, would be fatigue, just because of the sheer amount of fixtures that City have. I could see him potentially missing one of those Champions League games where they're basically nailed on to finish top of their group and to qualify into the next round. So that would be the chance that he would get to rest, because he's so critical to the City team, isn't he? I did look at what Pep had said about him recently as well. And he said, it's not about rest. I saw he was a little exhausted mentally. Right now, I use the players who are in better conditions or more focused. If the players think they have been rested because I am rotating, they have made a big mistake. I think from that, it's pretty clear that, for De Bruyne, it's all about playing him when he is fit and playing him as much as possible. And there's no real physical exhaustion. It's just a mental exhaustion, because he is trying to, carry the team. And, some of the results recently haven't been too great, and he looks a little bit frustrated, I guess, on the pitch and to a certain extent as well.
Pre-restart last year, so the game week 129, 178 points, 6.13 points per game. Post-restart, a ridiculous 9.13 points per game. But has he kept up this year, looking at the data? No, he hasn't. 39 points he's scored so far, equal to the likes of Bednarek, and outscored by luminaries such as Gabriel, Mings and WBA's keeper Johnston. But he's missed games, and City have not been in gear. And we definitely are signs of recovery. As recently as game week 7, their 10 goals was an overperformance. Now it's a little bit better. They've got XG of 15.6, 15 goals scored. They're ninth in the XG metrics now. But what's really interesting is still the contrast last season. So obviously there's a game less played, but last season at this point, their XG was 31.07. They'd scored 32 goals. This season, they scored 15. In 2018-19, their XG was 27.88. They'd scored 27 goals. This season, again, they've scored just 15. It's a very anemic start for City. And I think the big loss has been Kun Aguero. 6 goals in 18-19 in the first 10, 8 last year in the first 10. And Nick mentioned David Silva a couple of weeks ago as well, being one of the other kind of main misses for them, obviously doing bits at the moment, Real Sociedad. But this year, it has been the defence which has been the main point, which is why I went for the Cancelo and Diaz on my wild card. They've had the fewest shots conceded, they're third threats, you see, and Boren Diaz, for example, is the man there. But I mean, KDB, I guess, is the way to buy into that attack, because there's just so much mix and rotation, right, Anthony? There's no other way to really go there. I mean, looking at players like Mahrez, you've got to look at them and think, I might do a throw on this actually, because I did look at his data, but I'm not going to do it in here. But some player like Mahrez is so feast or famine, you need the consistency for FPL, don't you?
Yeah, this is the thing. And I think as well, maybe an aspect that's a little bit overlooked with Man City so far this year is just, I think this is something you'll hear commentators talk about quite a bit, is that a malaise sets in with Pep's methods at a club after a while, and players just stop responding to him. They just become, too mentally fatigued from it, whatever. And you'd have to wonder if that was starting to affect the squad. I think people were quite surprised to see that he'd extended his contract and he's going to stay for another few years. This is the longest he's ever been at a single club, Pep. So we have definitely seen a marked change in Pep's quotes post-game. Like, he was, you'd rarely see him be as strong and fervent about the fact that he did not try to rotate. He picked the best players that were in form and they were had the right attitude, etc. It was a very, very different approach to talking about team selection to what we're used to. Usually there's a sense of, oh, we have big game coming up and everyone's tired and it's all awful. But no, that wasn't the case at all. It was a really, really different thing. But as you say, KDB, no matter what, integral to it if they can. Fortunately, City seem to be marching through in the Champions League. They're already through. They can secure first against Porto, and I don't think KDB will even need to play it this week. So in a good position in that sense to just keep KDB ticking over in the league, because it's important that he does. Because he is, if you just from the eye test, he's the one that makes them tick. He's dangerous. He gets the ball to players in terms of, let's say, Mara stole the show against Burnley, but still KDB was second in terms of shots and he was second in terms of chance created, both to Mara's. But really, you know, he's just always there knitting everything together, assisting the assister, etc. In the last six, for example, he's 16th in the league for shots. That's third overall. The mad thing is only two of those have been on target. And for another player, we think, oh, you know, get rid. You know, everything's wrong. His XGOP in the last, his XG from open play over the last four, it's just 0.57. The stats are against him. You know, you could argue he's even over trying, but you don't feel that when you actually watch the games. He's hit the post, he's been close, he's been unlucky. There's been an awful lot of blocked shots as well, for example. He's creating away all the time. He's kind of different. There's a bit of a Bruno Fernandes-esque thing to him that maybe you can ignore the stats to some extent and just know that if City are purring, KDB is going to be ticking along nicely. And when they score five, to have only got two returns in that seemed actually quite small, and you felt quite unfortunate that they hadn't got an awful lot more. So just look, overall, I think KDB, if City are going to be on form and the fixtures suggest they should be, is pretty integral to that and should probably be a part of your team.
And we own him, so probably that is true.
Way.
Way, indeed. And then I think the final thing here, I mean, obviously because we've got Vardy, does have a few good games, and it's obviously one of those players you could fit in very nicely. Luckily, the Chelsea players just about fall out of this, luckily in terms of time rather than luckily in terms of not being interesting. For example, Ziyech, utter BS. last two games, four chance created, 0.17 XA, identical stats to James McCarthy. But I think the next thing to speak about is...
A bit Dusan Tadic,
yeah,
dare
I say. A little bit. I don't know who said that. Sounds like a ghost of Christmas past. But I think the thing to talk about quickly is the Spurs players. Obviously, a lot of people will be sitting there with one or maybe even two of the Son and Kane are still lingering on. I saw a really good point today by our friend Alan, Desperately Can Dusan. He said, well, you know, if you've held Kane for this long, you know, you've held him through Man City, you've held him through Chelsea, surely it's the point now where, I mean, you obviously he has fallen 0.1, but if you've bought him a little while, you've had him there, you've had him ticking over, surely with Vardy just getting an assist, and he was the last sort of exit point today against Fulham, you must just hold on to Kane, right? What are you going to do? What would you be doing, Nick, if you were holding on to one or both of these players? You've both got some coverage, so I'm interested to see what your views are.
I mean, I haven't really had much of an opportunity to jump off, to be honest, without taking hits. And I just didn't really see it worth taking the -8 this week anyway, at least to bring in Vardy. I've ended up net -1 from that move. So I kind of got away with it. It just didn't really sit with me. I think I was already getting rid of Son, and I kind of thought, you know, take both out on a -8. That's beyond my risk profile, even the new me who takes risks with my moves and goes for ambitious strategies. That was beyond me. So I decided to keep Kane. I've seen him put some decent performances against Chelsea before. We always see him egged up for those London derbies. So I kind of fancied us to potentially show a little bit more than perhaps what we did going forward. Because against Man City and Chelsea, Kane's only actually had one goal attempt. And Son's only had two goal attempts during those two games, but all of them outside the box as well. So not particularly exciting for Spurs from an attacking perspective in those games, but that was kind of how Jose Mourinho clearly set up to play, digging deep, and got the results that he wanted ultimately from those games as well. 4 points, we should be very happy as Spurs fans in terms of where we are in the league. But yeah, you're right.
Worth mentioning as well, though, the fact that, you know, Chelsea certainly set out to avoid conceding any goals as well. Like, Frank Lampard has definitely taken on board criticisms that they have been a bit leaky, especially in big games, and he really tightened up as a consequence of that. And City, as Tom has noted, probably the best defence in the league, and statistically are the best defence in the league. So with that in mind, you know, you can't hold those against them. What you could hold against them is the fact that Kane wasn't exactly prolific, or in terms of shots against the likes of Brighton, West Brom, Burnley before that. And that's maybe the one what I'd like to kind of hear from you about, Nick.
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of the goal attempts, I think over the course of the season, I think he was only second to Bamford. Last time I checked for goal attempts, that might be an out-to-date stat. But it's more kind of the assists that Kane has brought to his game that's been super impressive this season. I think he's been watching. He's a big fan of NFL, and he's obviously been watching a lot of quarterbacks, throwing the ball from distance, and the men on the end running onto it, because that's essentially what he's doing. He's playing so deep, and he'll do the through balls towards Son, and Son will get on the end of those chances and score. And that's really what has made Kane this such amazing sort of FPO asset this season, isn't it? All these assists that he's come up with as well. So he's had 9 assists, which is just ridiculous so far. And he's also still had 7 goals. He's obviously on penalties as well, which will increase his goal threat. So from that perspective, I think he's still a great FPL asset. You mentioned, you know, the Brighton, West Brom games, but he did score against them. So, you know, he's still got returns there as well. Spurs have Arsenal up next. I can understand why managers perhaps still might be looking to sell, especially if they're trying to fit in, you know, those midfielders, which probably right now are looking like better FPL assets than Kane, partly because of the positioning as well. But there are flexibility. You talk about like downgrading Kane to Wilson or something to bring in an extra midfielder. But I think it just pretty much depends on your team, and I can understand why some managers might decide to go without Spurs now.
Yeah, this is the thing. Like, I was stirring with you there a bit ago, just to bring up the Brighton and West Brom games, because the fact of the matter is that the stats have been poor over the last 4, and that's obviously including, as you say, the City games and the Chelsea games. He's had just 10 shots in that period. Son had 6, so even less again. That means that Kane, 39th for XG from open play, which is the same as George Baldock. So, you know, it's quite poor in that sense. But the fact of the matter is, with Kane, he's the likely man. And we've talked about Talisman before. He certainly personifies that. You could say Son does too, but continue with me. Kane certainly personifies that. And look, if Spurs want to win the league, and they certainly do want to win the league, and they have the facilities to do that, they need to be able to win games against underperforming sides like Arsenal. It's Palace, then it's Liverpool. That could be a tight game, but really all the rest of the games that are coming up, you would expect Spurs to be able to get 1 or 2, and you would think that Kane is more than likely to be part of, you know, at least half of those, and there's always the penalties on the end there ready to make any score a haul. And with that in mind, when you've got a player with his finishing, and he's on form, I think I called him one of the most informed players in Europe over the last 2 pods, and I agree with that. Like, he continues to kind of confound expectation in terms of both goal threat and creativity.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think that obviously after those tough fixtures have abated, suddenly he becomes on the menu, doesn't he? Especially over Christmas, where we all have Kane. We all know Kane.
Is Arsenal a tough fixture for him, Tom?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I'm talking about the Liverpool fixture, actually.
Okay.
And maybe the Leicester fixture to some extent. But you've got to have an eye on the fact that over the 15 to 17, where the game's obviously quite bunched up, Wolves away is obviously not fantastic, but the 30th December against Fulham at home and the 2nd of January against Leeds at home, I mean, the 16 and 17 in particular, those are captionable games for Kane, and those are kind of the games where I'd be looking to bring him back in. And as you said, kind of, he is still in form, he still inhabits that sort of talisman role, and he has the X-Mins. He's going to be playing the majority of the minutes, if not all the minutes, for Mourinho during that time period. Yeah, I mean, but I still don't own either of them. And to move us on to the end of the section, those are the ones who do miss out for me still, just because the fixtures for the short term are still probably not ones that I want to buy into. So if you own these players, it's a don't buy, don't sell. But for me, I'm looking at their fixture list and thinking, as I mentioned, that Fulham and Leeds double up. Those are the 2 games, 16 and 17, and then we want Spurs back. As it is, I'm hoping the players that I do have cover. I'm hoping that continues on. And the other big miss at the moment is Liverpool, as we spoke about earlier on. I think Jota is going to be the way I go to try to help me cover all the bases. Because as it stands, I have De Bruyne, I have Bruno Fernandes, I've got kind of the staples like Grealish. I do have Ziyech at the moment, and I've got Vardy up front, as well as Calvert-Lewin. These are all players who are going to be kind of those hygiene factors in our teams. And the risk is that obviously those players all look a bit immovable at the moment as it stands, which means that if Salah becomes a must-own, and I've got to follow a Nick type strategy of doing the merry-go-round, the hokey-cokey to bring him in. I mean, one way to mitigate it might be that I pair Jota with Robertson and try to make that work in terms of covering the points from Liverpool. So, I mean, you guys both own Spurs players and presumably things are going on. Anthony, you're looking for a way to fit in Bruno. Is it still him that misses out for you? How are you approaching all this?
This is the thing, Tom. I'm trying to build a team that has Kane, De Bruyne, Salah and Bruno. And it may mean that Jota, the most affordable of all of them, is the one to miss out as I continue to just overstretch myself to get all these players in. It's becoming a more and more tenuous and impossible strategy to try and chase. But that's where I continue to be. Maybe I just can't bear FOMO, and maybe that's the real issue at the heart of my season here. But realistically, I just feel that covering my bases and continuing to try to just not miss the big points and to get my captaincies right might well be the strategy that carries me through this. I don't want to depend on any one team, because I feel that that won't necessarily go well. It didn't go well for me when I depended on Liverpool double up previously this year. I think I may have had a City double up at the start of the season or quite close after I wildcarded, and that wasn't necessarily the best idea. I never had the Spurs double up, and that would have been great when it was going well. But at the same time, I think just trying to spread myself out and trying to get things right is probably the easiest way to avoid misery.
Yeah, I kind of prefer this sort of version of FPL, at least, where there isn't such a strong set template and you kind of have to take a few... I know this sounds like a new me again. You have to take a few risks, a few gambles here and there with players that you don't own, and there's a bit of a danger for it. Because I think this week I felt particularly exposed, actually, just because I didn't have Vardy, I didn't have Salah or Mane, I didn't have Werner or Ziyech, I didn't have... Sterling or Jesus even from Man City. I was going into the week without De Bruyne or Jota as well. So I was feeling very, very exposed in that regards. And I'm thinking about, the upcoming weeks and how I do try and mitigate the risk for the next few weeks. And, as we kind of discussed, Jota could potentially... He could cover Salah to a certain extent. He could try and be the Riker for those weeks. But I'm not sure if I want to take that gamble. I took the gamble with Vardy this week. But I think with Salah, he's just... With Fulham away, it just feels like you're going to shoot yourself in the foot not owning him. That's my danger here. And I think, many managers perhaps would have looked at City this week and De Bruyne and looked at the ownership as well and thought, actually, I'm not too scared about De Bruyne because his ownership is low. Problem is that ownership is increasing and increasing right now. So there's going to be another 300,000 odd engaged managers to own him. I think he was 5% at one point. Now he's up to 20% ownership. So the longer you leave it, not owning a guy like this as well, it becomes more and more dangerous. And I was also looking at Son as well this week. His ownership was still very scary at 57.5%. So a lot of that is Ed's teams, but he's another one perhaps that, I quite like the fact that I've still got Kane in my team, that I can cover Spurs with Kane. They're certainly not the case for both right now, even though they've got past a couple of those tougher fixtures. But I do like the idea of hanging on to one of them. And like yourself, Anthony, and yourself as well, to a certain extent, Tom, I want to try and cover them all. And that's why I'm thinking if I have to maybe take a -4, do a bit of premium ping pong, then that will be the strategy so I can cover the best players for the best fixtures as much as possible over the next sort of 5 to 6 game weeks.
So there you have it, people. Premium ping pong, the way to deal with everything, because otherwise you can't catch them all. You can never be an Ash Ketchum. Right, let's move on to the correspondence and Q&A after this quick break.
Who got the assist?
So we're back and it's time to catch up with the Who Got The Assist mini league. If you want to join the league, the code is CPSULF. So I'll do a quick rundown of the top five again. In fifth, it's Zaki Shane with the Zakaria team. 67 points for him this week. In fourth, it's Graham Sessoms, HK10 for Golden Boots. With 62 points, then it's the Zakaria Mokroy, Zaki team two. Seems a bit familiar, that. 44 points though this week for Zaki team two. In second, it was Borisov Joksimovic. I'm not going to try and say his team name, with 52 points. And in first, it's David Izzet. He's risen to the top of the league with Hest Wham Untied with an excellent 71 points this game week. It's just a ridiculous score, isn't it? And overall rank 96 now. So David's having an amazing season this season. He's got Wilson, of course, and Grealish and Captain Fernandez, Chilwell and Jota, all the key men. So well done, David. That's excellent.
Yeah, well done, David. Yeah, door open to a potentially winning it from here, I suppose. Right, let's move on to the correspondence then, the thing that makes an Irishman squeal. Yep, it's the correspondence section. And to introduce it and to get overly excited at reading out, it's Anthony. And this week it's one that's been on the back burner for a while, isn't it?
Yeah, we got this one. I'm going to read it all in a monotone there. No, we got this one about a month ago, so we only just got around to it. The correspondence section is, of course, your chance to share your thoughts on the goings-on in FPL, to put your own addendum to a previous show topic, or share whatever else is on your mind, from poetry to a drawn-out comparison between Arsenal season and the Titanic. This week's email is from Tom, who's at FPL_sponge on Twitter. Hi, Anthony, Tom and Nick. Only writing this to make Anthony happy and save this section on the pod. But a topic recently on my mind, which I think is undervalued in the FPL community, is the impact of team playing styles on their perceived fixture difficulty ratings and therefore expected FPL points. Often, fixtures are seen as easy on paper, but turn out to be a banana skin in reality, or vice versa and delivered unexpected points. A common example of this is the high-performing counter-attacking team up against a bottom-half side who can park the bus effectively, i.e. Spurs' 1-1 draw with Newcastle in Game Week 3. Or the flip side, a team who can unlock defences and perform well with lots of possession, but struggle when opponents don't sit back and defend, i.e. Man City 1-1 against Leeds in Game Week 4. The same principle can be applied to individual players, like Hazard when he was out in the left wing versus dodgy right-backs, or the less obvious team playing styles where a team puts a lot of crosses into the box to score headers, or teams who concede the most headed chances. In summary, should FPL managers consider team playing styles more when assessing fixture difficulties and look to target specific matchups for captaincy? Many thanks, FPL Sponge. Nicholas.
Yeah, so I would say 100% that these types of things need to be factored into your decision making, as the sort of the commentary said. We obviously quite a stats driven pod, but you know, it's not always about the stats. You have to look at what's actually happening on the pitch, whether it's the managers of the particular clubs or the managers of the opponents, how they're going to tackle the game. And often it also depends a little bit on, you know, the form of the opponents. For instance, if you're playing a lower reaches team that seems to be playing with a lot of confidence, playing fast flowing attacking football, then you might fancy, you know, your premium assets against them compared to some of these teams that we know traditionally shut up shop. You know, you got your likes of Burnley, the likes of Newcastle under Steve Bruce, you know, the likes of West Brom. And we talked about West Brom a little bit earlier when Harry Kane and Spurs played against them. And just as a sort of a Spurs fan, I found that incredibly frustrating watch. They only got a goal quite late in the game, and it was just like 10 men behind the ball. It was very turgid. It was unattractive, unexciting football. And, you know, to think about when you're targeting a player that's playing West Brom, and I'm guilty of this to a certain extent because I've captained my players against West Brom three times this season, you know, you should be factoring in the fact that your players are going to struggle to break through this team just because they're not going to be pressing forward, they're not going to be attacking. In comparison, you know, someone like Southampton, who obviously we saw Spurs demolish earlier in the season because they did have that high line that was highlighted. You might fancy your assets a little bit more against them because they are going to, you know, this seems to be more Hasenhüttl's style of management there. He does get them to play aggressive pressing play, trying to move forward, you know, distribute down the lines, that sort of thing. So I think certainly that is something you need to factor in. And it's also, it's not always the worst teams. We've talked about Jamie Vardy many times on this podcast, how he likes Manchester City, he loves to play against Manchester City, and he inevitably always seems to return against them as well because they always attack the ball. And Jamie Vardy just waits on the edge of that, you know, final defender, and he'll get a couple of through balls for sure. You know he will, like every time he plays them, and inevitably he will, you know, have a couple of chances against them compared to perhaps other teams which will perhaps man mark him a little bit closer or not, you know, have the defenders play forward. And he can't play that classic Leicester counter-attacking strategy that we've all kind of known to love.
No, definitely. I think that's a really good point, actually, because obviously we do often look at stats and say that that's kind of the main way we derive insight into what's going on. But as Nick's saying, those situations are just so important in order to kind of look at the differences between games and really assess what may be the potential of the outcome in terms of those matchups. It's a great point on Vardy, and I think I completely misappropriated that, actually made a big mistake in captaining him versus Liverpool, and maybe some hindsight there to some extent, but maybe I did kind of think, yeah, okay, against Man City he had that sort of ability to play off the shoulder, exploit the space and score goals. I was hoping that would happen against Liverpool, but it seems like Klopp didn't fall into that error. But equally, you know, that week I avoided Bruno versus West Brom because I thought, you know, West Brom would play the low block and they frustrate United. United aren't the sort of team who are going to be able to make inroads against a team playing like that. And I was almost right. It took a retaken penalty to prove me wrong. But it's just one of those things, isn't it? Where I think it is very, very important to look at those sort of things, like the counter-attack potential, as Tom mentioned, you know, Son against Southampton, a fantastic example. I think probably my biggest bugbear, one of my biggest bugbears in FPL, is the FDR scale, which is awful. And that often is the way in which people do take as a shorthand for assessing fixture difficulty. Because, I mean, FDR is a 5-point scale in which the 1 is almost always redundant and the 5 is most of the time redundant, so as not to offend people, effectively. So you end up with a 4-point, or basically a 3-point scale, which is useless. And the points are just silly too. They lack nuance. It's a blunt instrument trying to tell you something which is quite complex, which is how much does this fixture suit one team versus another? So I glanced ahead to the next couple of weeks. I spotted that this week going on, for example, Man City is a 2 at home to Fulham. Okay, Fulham have just managed to beat Leicester, but that 2 is the same as the 2 given for Villa, who are playing Burnley. Those two games, okay, the outcome may be, you know, to some extent similar, but the games aren't quite comparable because you've got one team which is, you know, massively superior to the other. No offense, Costas, but I'm sure you know that. Versus Villa and Burnley, I don't think that is a 2 for Villa because of Burnley's the record of defending very, very well. So it means it's very important to suss out that sort of extra context surrounding those sorts of games. We always say that stats are part of, not the full picture. And in terms of captaincy as well, you do want it to ideally be the highest scoring game of that game week, don't you? And the average will normally track if the obvious captain scores highly. I think that's probably just the proof is always in the pudding week to week on that. And it's always very good to be captaining a player in that game where things do absolutely go mad. But I mean, what do you think, Anthony? Is it always the case that this is what's going on, that fixture difficulty is one of those things where it's more about the playing style of the teams rather than looking at things like the FDR as your shorthand to seeing how good or bad the fixture is?
Yeah, I definitely avoid the FDR. I think I would bet any manager that's listening to us can probably put together a mental FDR that's probably more useful than that particular FDR. And it can be definitely a little bit misleading, to say the least. It'd be very silly to discount playing styles when you look at these things. Tom, like you, with Bruno Fernandes and Manchester United against West Brom, Tom a few weeks ago, I didn't fancy him purely because United have really struggled against defences that sit back like that. And I maintain that. And this West Ham game in game week 11 is going to be no different to them to that. However, you know, all points said earlier in this pod about Bruno Fernandes, fixture proof, etc., means that I'm no longer going to continue with this strategy when it comes to somebody like Bruno Fernandes. And I think that kind of gets at the conditionality of this, that, okay, maybe it's worth thinking about this playing styles thing to a point, maybe particularly with your captaincy. But when it comes to just your selections in general and your transfers in general, maybe give it less weight. So maybe, for example, Fulham is an interesting one. Maybe this is a theory I'd like to test out over the next few weeks and to maybe look back a little bit further. But I captained Dominic Calvert-Lewin against Fulham in game week 9, and that obviously worked out better than the Vardy captaincy this week. Now, you would say, okay, but what's the difference? You know, they're Fulham playing against a team that's doing much better than them in the league. But the difference is the type of finisher, for example, between Jamie Vardy and Dominic Calvert-Lewin, for example. Easy for me to say that with hindsight, and that's why I'd like to test this out over a further time, is that Dominic Calvert-Lewin as a first-time finisher who just, you know, he just makes the most of a chance when it comes straight away versus Jamie Vardy, who's more of a run-onto and finish, albeit first-time player. Maybe is that little bit of a distinction, which is why, of course, as Nick said, Vardy is particularly good against really good teams like City. Maybe this is why against Fulham he struggled. I'm not going to give you any sort of like massive treaties on that, but I would like to see that kind of going forward on that particular fixture. West Brom's another interesting one who have, as Nick said, kind of confounded our expectation and done a lot better against the bigger teams, let's say, than we would have expected, even though if you look at their stats in terms of shots conceded and things, they're right up there at the top. But Sam Johnstone is a huge part of that, but they don't actually concede that many goals, West Brom, and maybe we've, you know, calibrated them incorrectly just based on fixture difficulty, whereas that playing style, as you say, is something we need to consider more, that they do sit back and they do try to not lose when they play the big sides, and that isn't necessarily a good thing. Compare that to Southampton against Spurs, the easy example, where, you know, they're chasing the win, they fancy it, and it explodes. Anyway, thanks very much to Tom FPL Sponge for emailing in for correspondence this week. If you want to be featured in the correspondence, get on to us at whogottheassist@gmail.com with poems, thoughts, comments, concerns, anything. We'll have a look and we'll probably get it into the pod at some point. We've had quite a lot of submissions over the last few weeks and it's been great to see it, but we'd like even more, guys. So keep this slot going from strength to strength. Isn't that right, Tom? Your favourite slot?
Yeah. Dead by Christmas, I reckon.
Here we go again.
Dear me. It's almost like I've given it a negative impetus to move forward. It's almost like it was a strategy from the beginning. Right, okay, let's move on to the Q&A after that bit of behavioural science and talk about some of the questions that were asked this week. Thanks very much for the questions. I know I didn't put them up very long, so those who got in, well done. But you know, for weeks going forward, I will try to leave it up for longer. But I think I only left up for 50 minutes this week because I had to go off for a meeting, so I was like, right, get onto the running order and then get on with my work, unfortunately. But the first thing this week was from Davy Peace, who asked, who will be FPL's top scorer this season and why is it Bruno Fernandes? So obviously we looked at Bruno earlier on, spoke about him in mostly glowing terms, apart from Nick, who's looking to get rid of him for a short term, in a little while. Who do you reckon is going to be the high scorer this season, guys? Is it going to be Bruno? Or do we think that the likes of Salah or last season's man, KDB, are going to rock through? Nick, what do you reckon?
I think there's certainly a few candidates out there, isn't there? Obviously, Son and Kane have had a brilliant start to the season, and I know they've been quiet this week, but they're up there, and Fernandes and Salah, you know, you could even put Grealish on an outside chance, I don't know, or Calvert-Lewin, very outside chance. But, you know, there's I think it's very hard to say who's going to end up being the guy that ends with the top score. It's probably going to be Salah. If I had to put money on it, I'd probably bet on Salah. But it probably depends on who can stay fit for the longest, ultimately, and avoid injury and maintain that form. But, you know, I think all of those guys I just mentioned will be up there in terms of 200 points, approximately, plus by the end of the season, I think.
Yeah, just given how competitive things have been so far this year and amongst those elite players, I think you're talking about really a player who can get north of 35 goal contributions in the season. That's give or take what you probably need to do it this year. Really, I think that's between Kane, Salah and Bruno Fernandes. If Kane can continue his playmaking exploits, then he would be a pretty good bet for it. But I think just going on historical pedigree and the fact that midfielders get that extra point for their goals, which does help, I think Mo Salah will still probably take it. I think he's got more players around him who will get him his assists. So whilst Bruno Fernandes and Kane might be more creative players, they don't have as many good finishers around them as Salah does. And I think that might pay dividends over the course of the year, especially as like the previous years, Firmino hasn't been finishing the chances as well as you might expect. And I think Jota is going to change that. There's kind of three primary goal scorers there, including Salah again. And I think that will benefit him maybe more so than at United, who, you know, they have great players there, great finishers there, the likes of Rashford, but not consistent enough maybe to help Bruno over the line. And for Kane, it's pretty much just Son. And if Bale, you know, really gets going, he could really deliver that extra edge for him.
I just wonder by game week 22 if we're going to be saying this sort of thing. So, I mean, I say that because that is when City's fantastic run for the time being ends. I mean, neither of you mentioned Kevin De Bruyne there last year, 36 goal involvements, but a really nice run over those next 12 game weeks that takes in Fulham, West Brom, Newcastle, Brighton, Palace, Sheffield United at home, as well as away games, the likes of West Brom again and Southampton, who surely are not going to be naive enough to play that high line. But I mean, by that point, could you be those 11 games, apart from arguably the United game, maybe the Chelsea game as well? Apart from that, I can see, you know, 15 goal involvements over those 11 games if City do turn it on, and he could well be in the running again. I mean, last year he only got above Salah, and obviously, Nick, I take your point that Salah is, in terms of the numbers, in terms of the pedigree, going to be the player who is going to be the guy you put your money on. But I can imagine De Bruyne getting a good proportion of his overall end points from these next 11 games, and that could be the way forward there. I do like Kane as well as an option there, Anthony. I was actually going to say him as being the guy who was going to be the dark horse, because the level of creativity, as we've mentioned, he's got 9 assists this season. He's got more assists than goals, Harry Kane. Easily, after 10 games, if it's 7 goals, 9 assists, he could end up with 20 goals and 20 assists. I mean, that would be revolutionary, wouldn't it, as an FPL asset, if he can do that when the fixtures turn? I mean, after, you know, obviously at the moment we're in a bit of a fallow period for fixtures, but from game week 14, that Leicester game, when that begins, they're only tough fixtures for pretty much for the end of the season. Our game week 20 against Liverpool, 22 against Chelsea, 24 against Man City. That's all I'd be worried about. The rest of the season is pretty much a solid run. So if you get him in, or at least you keep him past, like, from now, then you've got a player there who could potentially be the high scorer who you've got in a kind of base price. Wow. Okay. He could be the one, I think, this year who's going to run Salah close to his money if KDB does not do the job. I think it would be a free horse race between those three. But I haven't run before. Maybe there will be somebody who comes out of nowhere and does it. I mean, obviously, you've got the likes of TAA and Robertson, who haven't done anything so far this season. If they're loads of clean sheets in that run for Liverpool, who knows?
They're just probably that little bit too far behind, you know,
TAA and Robbo at this point.
Yeah, I think with De Bruyne.
Whereas go for it, Nick.
I was just going to say, I think with De Bruyne, certainly he's going to be one of the highest scorers over that particular period, but I think he's probably a little bit behind already. He's got a lot of catching up to do. He's 34 points behind Salah and Fernandes. He's over 40 points behind Son, actually, who's the current top scorer right now, 48 points behind him. I think Kane is really interesting. He'd be brilliant as a fan if he can get that 20 goals and 20 assists, because I think it's only Thierry Henry that's actually done that before.
Yes, it is.
That would be great to see. It depends whether he can maintain that form.
Yeah, the reason why I had De Bruyne that little bit further back was A, because he is at a deficit already, but B, I think just as City do go further into the Champions League, they can't possibly, you know, mess it up again. And I think De Bruyne will possibly be rotating out of the team then. I know we've talked about how he is, you know, the solution to Pep Roulette right now. That's when they're trying to build up their points. If City can build up a breathing space at the top of the league, which is not impossible over this next run. Everyone is dropping points. There's, I think if everyone won their games in hand and everything, you could have seven teams within 6 points of the top or something like that. It's ridiculous how tight things are at the moment. So a team that goes on a winning run, and we've seen the likes of Liverpool, we've seen Chelsea, we've seen City all do it, where they go well up towards 15 wins in a row. Like if they did that, that could be the league wrapped up. And so with that in mind, De Bruyne could then just kind of find himself as in and out of the team. And we have seen that previously when they're going further in the Champions League. And really, that has to be the objective for this City team over the course of this year. It's really Bayern to beat.
Absolutely. And that observation that there may be some rotation, I think, is another one, which we really should claim on social media, Anthony.
Please talk about Pep Roulette. Hashtag Pep Roulette WGTA.
that segues very nicely into the next question. So Abindra Somali asks, if City are now off on a run following their annual home demolition of Burnley, because obviously next they've got Fulham, and I think that all three of us later on, shock horror, are going to say Rooney captaining Kevin De Bruyne, barring a Newcastle under-15s team put out, in which case Grealish may be of interest. But they've got Fulham, United, Nick won't be selling for that, but we'll be buying him back in again for West Brom, Southampton, Newcastle, Everton and Chelsea over the Christmas period. Does that look fruitful? I've already given my answer that I think it probably is. It's probably one of those kind of time frames where I'm thinking that De Bruyne is going to come back to prominence. And obviously City against Burnley did show signs that they were becoming more settled, albeit when it was saying about players who score and keeping the team, et cetera, et cetera. What do you guys think about that?
Look, I think we've all... Well, I've certainly expressed my feelings on City's run that I do think that they will go well, and I'm not too worried about that United game. Defensively, they haven't been spectacular so far this season. Dean Henderson may be in goals if Taya is injured, which could be an interesting one. But at the same time, City have had the better of the Manchester derbies lately, especially actually at Old Trafford, more so. And I think that I wouldn't be too concerned by that particular game either. So, yes, do I think City are off on a run? Certainly enough to merit getting one of their players in.
Yeah, I think that's a sort of line there that City have some fantastic fixtures. We're all on De Bruyne. You know, there are cases for a double up or even a triple up if you're willing to take some risks. But, you know, like we just don't know who else is going to play, do we? So that's the problem. Maybe even you could say with Aguero out that Jesus becomes an option perhaps in the forward line if you're fancying a swap of Kane or Vardy out. So he may be one to be considering, the premium Calvert-Lewin, if you will, which we used to call him disparagingly, because both Calvert-Lewin and him miss a lot of chances, but Calvert-Lewin has changed his ways. So that's an old saying. We'll have to find a new one for him. But you know, Jesus only has 2 goals so far this season, which is pretty dreadful considering he's played quite a few games. But I don't know. We'll have to see with him. I think he's certainly an option.
Yeah, so we'll move on then towards a question about mid-price midfielders. And Seb Slade actually emailed in to whogottheassist@gmail.com for the correspondence section, but we thought this question was pertinent enough to just get it in here in the Q&A instead. So Seb is saying that he was early on the James hype, but that's obviously now a fond memory, having captained him in game week 4 for him. So with those serial blanks in mind, he's looking at a replacement. Now, assuming that most people own Grealish, Seb pointed out that Diogo Jota is an option. We've already spoken about Fernand Torres, who Seb suggests could be a huge differential. And he also has James Ward-Prowse in here, who is the 6th highest scoring mid. So anyone else, lads, or those three mid-price midfielder options, what do you think for Seb?
Yeah, I think it's got to be Jota, isn't it, at this point? I mean, we've obviously waxed lyrical, or at least I did wax lyrical about him earlier on. And I think that he probably is the one that you'd be eyeballing and thinking, you know what, it's a bit of a no-brainer, as we've mentioned. Apply the not less engaged manager mindset. He's the one to just buy, bring in, leave in your team, and enjoy the price rise, enjoy the points. I'll be hoping to do that next week. but yeah, it's definitely one of those where, if you are in that situation, I'm almost envious that you've got that kind of sense of an obvious transfer. I'm assuming that Seb has DCL, so he can sell James. Even if I didn't own a DCL, I probably would be looking to sell James, actually, so it doesn't matter too much.
I don't know if he has DCL.
Yeah, fine. I even putting that in DCL, I'll probably look and see how Hammers here, because I mean he was very unlucky actually on the weekend, wasn't he? He could have scored two goals, was it? They got ruled out. But the fixtures are coming thick and fast, and there's always that sort of English mentality. First season for a foreign player, things are getting cold, things are getting wet. Can they keep it up against Stoke on a Tuesday evening? As for his other options, I think Ferran could be a very interesting differential, actually. I do agree with him there. It depends on whether he is going to be the rotation. Obviously he's going to be a rotation threat. It's more about where the ceiling lies with him, I suppose. He's going to get probably 70, 80 minutes per City game, depending on other games during the week. And he's one of those you're going to have to keep an eye on and have Pep Roulette in mind for. JWP, I think he's one of those players who is a fantastic zombie team addition. He's just so good if you are not going to be messing with your team very much. And obviously you are going to get those kind of double-digit hauls every now and again, which is amazing for the price point, 6.0. Yeah. I look at that, even though he's sit high scoring mid, and think, well, if there is a procession of blanks when Southampton aren't in form and not doing very much, and he's just getting two or three every week, would you want to moving out? I probably would. So I think Jota's always going to be one there for now, because he is fundamentally, as we've said before, an attacking player playing for the league champions. I think it's a bit of a no-brainer. Nick, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I'd agree with you there on Ward-Prowse. I feel like he offers a lot in terms of dead ball situations, and he scored some worldy free kicks. But outside of that, I don't see too much attacking threat from him. So you're just kind of relying on those free kicks and those goals, those assists from corners and things like that from him, I think, to a certain extent. Yeah, Torres, obviously, he's one perhaps for the future alongside Foden. But if they're not going to start, then no point going for those guys. Obviously, you mentioned Grealish and Jota. Those are the guys in my team, and they're the ones that I would say are the best at that price point. You know, there's a few other people, if you're going a bit cheaper down the line at the 5.5s, so starting to catch the eye, like Pedro Neto at Wolves, who was very good this week and starting to get some attacking returns as well. Might potentially even be leading the line in Jimenez's absence, we don't know. But he got a goal and assist against Arsenal, and he's only 5.5. And some of the Leeds guys as well, maybe even Jack Harrison, for instance, is seeming to be the creative force there. He's created 23 chances, which is a third for all the midfielders right now. And and Leeds fixtures aren't too bad either in the short term. So another one perhaps cheaper there to consider.
Yeah, I think I can really only echo what all of you guys have said. Diogo Jota would stand out for me. One player you just didn't mention who's just an alternative option again in this list would be Mason Mount, who just, you know, continues to look extremely competitive and, you know, is continuing to get his minutes, really does try, will get in the right positions occasionally. 6.8 million is probably a little steep, and I think that's probably the reason why you'd have to favour some of the other options you've mentioned, but worth throwing him into the conversation as well while we're
not
there.
As good as Grealish, though, is he, Anthony? Let's be fair.
No,
let's move on to cheap forward preferences. So Chris Smith at FPL Moth says cheap forwards are looking great value this year, but which will we prefer, especially if it allows us to funnel cash into midfield premiums? I think before this game, we kind of said Mr. Watkins, but being 15 points down than where I thought I would be with Watkins, missed penalty. A penalty not given last week, and an offside goal, Varan incoming. No, I'm joking. I'm an idiot. I think that I'm probably going to say Bamford at the moment. I saw an absolutely ridiculous stat this week on, I think it was XG Philosophy on Twitter, which genuinely blew my mind about what's been going on with Patrick Bamford. But he has a higher non-penalty XG than Salah, Sterling and Fernandes combined this season. I mean, the guy, even though he's the inverse of the kind of forward you want, he is not good at scoring obvious chances. He scores very nice goals, low XG goals. He does not score tap-ins, that guy. But he is scoring points, and you're in the volume game where you're saying, okay, he gets loads of shots, therefore he will eventually score. I think that he is one of those that you can put a bet on. I think at the moment he'll be. I am a little bit of okay. Last few games he has blanked, but I'm a little bit sad about not buying him over Watkins. I think he's going to be one of the players who could do well over the course of the season just because of the volume of chance he's going to get. He's not a Mope. He's not a Mitrovic in that he is going to continue to get quite high quality chances to produce him by that Bielsa system. So I think he would be the one that I'd be really kind of underlining as being a decent, cheap forward asset. The other one's Antonio, who before he got injured, I was obviously all over, did bring in, and I got a nice kind of goal out of him against Man City before he got injured again. Obviously going to need time for him to build up, but he is the talisman of that West Ham team. He's the one who makes things happen. Today they were obviously reliant on Bowen to some extent, but when him, Antonio and the supporting cast have got going, I think that he is going to be the one who really energises that attack, and the West Ham are pretty decent. So I think he'll be the one for me, and I think actually is the top for me in terms of the hierarchy of cheap strikers. I mean, like Che Adams and stuff. Actually, Nick, you own Che Adams, don't you? I mean, is he the guy you'd be pointing out here?
So I do like Che Adams, and he's been doing a pretty decent job for my team in recent weeks, sort of propping up with the odd goal and the odd assists. And in that respect, I got him, I think, at 5.8 million as well. So from a pure price and economics perspective, he looks great. I've looked at some of the similar players to you. Obviously, nice Bamford looks great in terms of the underlying stats, you know, amazing volume of goal attempts. The one actually that I wanted to call out perhaps as the best pick was when you didn't mention that was Callum Wilson, 6.5 million. So Villa, yeah, I like Watkins as well, but I think with Grealish, I don't think it's worth tripling up on Villa. If a lot of us have Martinez or defender as well, I think Watkins is avoidable. So yeah, for me, it's just Callum Wilson. The fixtures are just great in the short term. Villa, West Brom, Leeds, Fulham at home, next four, so some really nice fixtures. He's looking like he's, you know, on form. He's the Newcastle talisman as well, 7 goals to his name. He's not has as many chances as the likes of Bamford, so only had 18, so 17 inside the box, but you know, 10 big chances taken, so a lot of his chances have been big chances. So you know, in terms of the underlying stats, it looks like Bamford's getting all the goal attempts because Leeds are creating so many. But I think Wilson with the short-term fixtures would be the one that I would target.
I think it's hard to watch Newcastle games, isn't it? That's the thing with Wilson. Like, you don't want to be watching those games. You want to just see what happens when the full-time whistle blows, because you know you've probably got points out of him if Newcastle have done anything. But actually watching them is, I prefer to watch paint dry, frankly. Anthony, what do you reckon here?
Yeah, I had that exact same thing written down about Callum Wilson, that, you know, he is great to own, but terrible to watch. But I do think he is the, well, not he in particular, but Newcastle are particularly terrible to watch. Now, Newcastle, it's the fixtures, really, as Nick pointed out. They're just so bloody good that I think it's very hard to ignore him. And he has been, I guess, the physical embodiment of the Mike Ashley cut your cloth club management way in terms of how efficient he has been with his finishing so far this season. 7 goals, quite a few of those have been penalties, and he's not wasting his big chances, but that's what you want. There's nothing wrong with that from your striker, and when you're able to get him in for a relatively cheap price of 6.5 million, I think it's fairly sensible. I do like Bamford, and what I do like about Bamford, and I was very skeptical about him pre-season, is yes, the quality of the chances that he gets, and all the stats show that, but it's the fact that he's getting chances against pretty much everyone is also very good. You know, the fact of the matter is that Callum Wilson doesn't get many chances, so you could quite easily point to it and say, if he goes off form, he's not going to get many chances to find form again. Bamford will, and arguably he's going to put away the chances, as Tom said, that you don't expect him to put away anyway. So there's a kind of a reverse psychology kind of thing going on with Bamford the whole time, which does make him quite a good pick, and at 6.1 as well, particularly good value. It's kind of the problem is, team structure wise, when we've talked about the amount of midfielders we want to get into our sides, you really only have space for one of these guys in your side, and that's the difficulty, especially if you want to get Calvert-Lewin in. It's very hard to make this all work, and certainly, picking one, I'd still go for Wilson short term for sure.
A slightly nerdy point actually that has just come to mind here is that when Wilson was at Bournemouth, he was big chances missed man, wasn't he? Last year, I think he had 20 big chances and scored 9 of them or something like that. Like, it something around that sort of province. 19 big chances, 8 goals scored. It's really interesting to see that kind of reversion for him from being, he's had a feast of big chances and only scores half of them, to now he's making the most of it. Is it a case that he's overperforming in that role and Bamford is underperforming given the big chance he's got? Well, obviously, we know Bamford from the championship is very, very wasteful. It's an interesting dynamic there. We're really intrigued to see how it plays out. Don't have any answers, but just an interesting point of view. And the final one this week is fans in stadiums, and it's another write-in from my friend Karam. You can find him at Karam Tizer on Twitter, and Nick and I have met him on the last couple of meetups. Very nice guy, right, Nick? Who has been a very nice friend of the pod over the last little while. Anthony, another correspondence one for you to read out and get excited by.
Yeah, it's a lovely letter as well. So, Cram, thanks a million for our brilliant efforts week in, week out, and we thank him for emailing in as well. So, basically, what Cram is asking about is, with fans expected to be back in stadiums from game week 11, we know that London, Liverpool, Brighton and Southampton will be able to welcome fans again in stadiums. So, many teams were impacted positively and negatively by fans' presence in Project Restart and over the course of so far this season. So, how should we read that from an FPL perspective? Guys, what are your thoughts on fans returning to stadiums, albeit in very, very small numbers? I think max 4,000, am I correct?
Yeah, it's very small. I think that there's one really, really good test case for how much fans impact performance, and that is Sheffield United, the team who are currently rooted at the bottom of the Premier League. At this point, looking at their down, sorry, Blades, but 1 point after 10 games. You've got to be thinking about Chris Wilder there, haven't you, really? I'm sure he'll be kept on. But 1 point after 10 games, rooted to the bottom of the table. This time last year, they were actually eighth. They had 13 points, and they're equal in points with the likes of Manchester United. And you've got to probably put that down to the fact that Bramall Lane creates that semblance of a very intimidating stadium, intimidating arena for players to play in. Obviously, it's an intangible thing when it comes to the data, but it's one of those things that gives players perhaps an extra 10%. And I think that we've all been there. We've all been in a high adrenaline situation. We've been able to pull out performances where other people haven't been able to. For my case, it's not playing in front of 50,000 people. It is being able to present in a corporate setting. But at the same time, I think it's one of those things that you can definitely empathize with. And I think it'll be interesting to see how the reintroduction of fans does begin to amp up players who were to play off them. And also how certain players, perhaps who weren't particularly good when it came to the pressure, could fall back by the wayside. I don't know. But fans coming back, Nick, what do you reckon is going to be the case there? What do you reckon is going to happen?
Yeah, hi, Karam. I think I'm not sure it's going to have that big an influence on the game, to be honest. And with the home form as well, it's only a small number that will be allowed into stadiums, I think 2,000 or so. And, from personal experience, I've always found sort of the home away form has been generally pretty speculative. I also read, apparently, I don't know if this is true or not, but I read that, you know, they're not going to be allowed alcohol. They're not potentially going to be allowed to shout or sing as well. So it'll be very interesting to see how it all works in practice. Obviously, as you said, some players, it might fill them with confidence. It might help, you know, teams like Sheffield United perhaps to have a few core ultras cheering them on to try and help them. Or, you know, other players we've seen before seemingly have played better without the fans there, cajoling them. They, you know, saw about West Ham, how they've actually performed better because they haven't had the pressure of the fans from the London Stadium, you know, abusing them essentially when things go wrong. Perhaps players like Joe Linton as an example, who really seemed to struggle. Most of his Newcastle career started to show a little bit of form recently, perhaps has benefited from the fact that he hasn't had a crowd jeer him every time he's missed a sitter. And so, you know, I think there'll perhaps be some elements, but I think from an FPL model, I think it'll be very hard to assess what these changes will do and if it will influence our decisions at all.
Yeah, for what it's worth, Graham, I don't think it'll make much of a difference from an FPL perspective. I think maybe occupying my role as the more negative of the three of us, I think that from the limited experiences we've had of games with a small number of fans in the stadium, so we've seen it in the international break, for example, Northern Ireland's playoff for the Euros, for example, had a crowd out against Slovakia in Windsor Park, and that was obviously a huge game for Northern Ireland, and I think it did make an atmosphere in spite of the fact that it was a small crowd, but it is a relatively small ground, whereas a lot of league games are quite run-of-the-mill. Take, for example, even West Brom, Aston Villa, or West Ham versus Aston Villa today, for example, is a good example of just your average mid-table clash, not a huge amount lying on it one way or another. And I think that might be comparable to when Ireland played Finland during the Nations League, and there were fans in the stadium. But geez, if anything, I think what it did was underline the futility of what's going on at the moment, that, you know, they're just putting a few people in just for the sake of it, just for the bit of PR. But really, the football is being continued on life support, and you have to kind of question, is it worth it in that sense for the clubs and for everyone involved? And are the players getting the buzz that they used to get out of it? And I think maybe that these fans returning will actually underline that, if anything, which isn't necessarily the best thing in the world. But from an FPL perspective, I don't see it really changing things. But anyway, let's move on from my slightly dark outlook on that and move towards the transfers and captains for the upcoming game week. Lads, what are you thinking?
So I think I've pretty much said it already that I'm planning on rolling my transfer and captaining De Bruyne. So if I roll it, then I need to fund Bruno to Salah with 0.3 million, which might mean a boring defender downgrade as well accompanies that. So that's kind of my plan, but it'll invariably be destroyed by some injury or someone getting COVID or something. So that's at least a short-term plan.
Same. Captaining De Bruyne, rolling transfer. Let's try to figure out what happens next week. I'm still pretty glad that I did Mane for De Bruyne, which I mentioned earlier on. So yeah, just leaving it as it is. I've got no Liverpool players, so that's definitely something I have to deal with. It probably will be Watkins if he was sacrificed, or maybe Vardy, maybe, who sacrificed a Liverpool player. I'm not sure yet. So quite a lot of things that I could possibly do. I'm glad to be in the position where I've got a decent sort of set of players. Lots of news that Newcastle apparently have had a big COVID outbreak. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I've got a triple Villa set up at the moment with Martinez, Grealish and Watkins. So if that game is called off, I'll be obliged to make a couple of moves there. But hopefully it doesn't happen, and hopefully I'll be all right and I'll be able to roll it. We'll see. But yeah, default is roll it, notwithstanding injuries, COVID, etc., etc. Anthony, finally?
Yeah, the thing with that Newcastle game, and it's one to monitor for everyone who's listening as the week goes on. As it stands right now, we know of kind of bottom line is it's very unlikely to be cancelled, it seems, right now. So with that in mind, Grealish would have to be consideration. But as it stands, just based on fixtures and imagining the world as it is normal, I think De Bruyne is leading the pack. And much as I want to get Bruno Fernandes into my side, I have 4.6 million in the bank. I'm not transferring out Grealish, obviously, with that in mind. But then the only player really who I can transfer out would be Suchek. But I don't have enough money there. So is it worth taking a hit to get Bruno Fernandes in, or do I go another week without him? But if I go without him in game week 11, I'll probably go without him for the derby in game week 12. And suddenly we're looking at multiple weeks of dreading Bruno Fernandes, goal emojis, and I'm not sure if I can deal with that. Anywho, that is the end of this week's pod. Thanks very much for tuning in. We were Who Got the Assist. Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button if you haven't already, and leave a review as well. They've slowed down in recent weeks. We'd love to get a few reviews in on iTunes to help us shoot up the charts a little bit more.
Yep, and of course, don't forget to send correspondence. It will keep Anthony very happy. You might even get another squeal from him.
Yep, great. Now, next week, we'll be back on Tuesday because these guys are both being professionally responsible. Anthony has an exam, Nick has an exam, which means we can't do the Monday, so we'll be back next Tuesday. In the meantime, we hope this helps you think about how we cover the bases in FPL at the moment. We'll speak to you next week on Tuesday. Goodbye.
It's on.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist? We'll be right back.
Social Podcast Network.